You can see us or no, I just don't think of
it. Saulo, que no me gusta. ¿Qué hay que hacer?
I don't know how to fix it.
Con este video de video.
Now? You see me? Yes. Okay.
Hi Peter, here is Luciano. I shall represent the Institute of Mathematics as a host institution for this habilitation. So can we start? Is it okay? So I shall start Peter formally. Yes? Are you?
Can we start?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Okay, it's a great pleasure. It's a great pleasure for me to open this quite special session here. It is the first habilitation in mathematics which takes place here, and that's just possible. And it's a honor for our institution the name of the candidate is Mihai Mihailescu from the University of Craiova. And we have here the commission. Oh, okay, I shall talk on the president of the commission and continue the.
Okay, do you hear us, Peter?
Yes.
Okay. Good. So I invite to start this presentation. And unfortunately, will you be able to see anything?
He's able to see his presentation.
Able to see the presentation.
Very good.
Okay. So the commission today is well. I will start with myself as the president, Sergiu Moroianu. Then Peter Hestu from Finland and Catalin Lechter from Cluj. So Mihai Mihailescu is from the University of Craiova and he will start his defense.
Thank you for the introduction. And I want to say thank you to Lucian for accepting to organize this this defense here at the Institute of Mathematics. So the title of my thesis is analysis of some EDTs and related problems. And first of all, I want to point out a few themes which are discussed in this thesis, the themes of this thesis. Actually, the most interesting fact that we want to study here is to investigate the existence, non-existence, multiplicity, and other qualitative properties of some partial differential equations, which are mainly of elliptic type. However, we not restrict our analysis to elliptic equations, and we enable the presence in a differential operators in some equations, some degeneracies or similarities, which lead to PDEs that are not completely ballistic in the whole domain where the problem is analyzed. Another goal would be to study some different situations or to investigate the asymptotic behavior of some power law functions. Regarding the structure of the thesis, it contains actually 6 chapters, and the main body of the thesis is given by the first 5 chapters. In the last chapter, the 6th one, we present some open problems which are formulated starting from the problems analyzed in the main body of the thesis, and we give some comments and some further directions of research. Now, there are a lot of results in the thesis, and because the time of presentation is limited, I consider just a selection of the results. I just want to point out that I will present 2 problems from the first chapter, 2 from the second, and 1 from the 5th chapter. The last chapter from the main, belonging to the main body of the thesis. Consequently, I will start with chapter 1, which is entitled the analysis of some eigenvalue problems. This chapter contains 4 sections. I will talk about problems from the first section and from the third section. Okay, anyway, through this chapter, omega in Rn will stand for a bounded domain, the boundary of this domain, denoted in this manner, will be assumed to be smooth. The first problem about what I want to talk here is problem 1. In this problem, in the left-hand side here, we have the Laplace operator, and in the right-hand side, we have a function f, depending on both x and u, and a real number lambda. On the boundary, in this first problem, we assume a Dirichlet homogeneous boundary condition. And in this context, a real number lambda will be called an eigenvalue of problem 1, if basically problem 1 possesses a non-trivial solution, which will be understood in a weak sense, in a variational sense. That means this equality here holds true. A non-trivial solution u from the above definition will be called an eigenfunction or an eigenvector corresponding to the eigenvalue lambda. Now, problems of type 1 were largely studied in the literature for particular functions f here in the right-hand side. For instance, in the very simple example, when f of x and u is equal, u, then problem 1 becomes problem 2, which is very well-known eigenvalue problem. Actually, we know everything about the set of eigenvalues for this problem, applying, for instance, Ritz-Fredholm theory for compact and self-adjoint operators. We can prove the existence of a sequence of eigenvalues, which is unbounded. Next, regarding the first eigenvalue, we can give a characterization from a variational point of view as being the minimum of this quotient here, which is the so-called real quotient associated to the problem. On the other hand, lambda 1 possesses some remarkable properties. For instance, it is simple. That means that if we consider 2 eigenvectors associated to lambda 1, one of the eigenvectors can be obtained from the other by multiplying with a non-zero real constant. Another property for lambda 1 is that it is isolated. The fact that lambda 1 is isolated basically means that there exists a neighborhood of lambda 1 where there are no other eigenvalues except in lambda 1. Another interesting property can be that the corresponding eigenfunctions of lambda 1 never change signs in omega. So this is just a very well-known example of problem 1 with f of x and u equal to u. But we can have here in the right-hand side other examples of functions. Like here is the here f of x and u is the absolute value of u in power b minus 2 multiplied by u. This time b is a number from the open interval 1, 2 stars standing for the critical so-called exponent. But we'll avoid the case b equal to 2 in order to avoid the a case, a problem to present it before. About this problem denoted here by 4, we can prove that it possesses a continuous family of eigenvalues, namely the interval, the open interval 0 infinity. So in other words, there are cases of functions f here in the right hand side when we obtain the set of eigenvalues as being a discrete set, and there are cases when the set of eigenvalues is a continuous family. And then we consider the following natural question. Can we consider a class of functions f in the right hand side such that on the one hand the problem that we wanted to study to possess a continuous family of eigenvalues, and on the other hand at least one more eigenvalue which is isolated in the set of eigenvalues? And we can give a positive answer to this question by considering function f of x and t as in relation 5 here. F is t when t is negative, and it is a certain function h when t is non-negative, h satisfying conditions h1, h3 here. Actually, condition h1 means that h is sublinear with a constant c belonging to the interval 0, 1. This fact is very important in the proofs, actually. Condition h2 asserts the existence of a positive constant such that the primitive of h with respect to the second variable is positive. Sorry, I think it is a problem with the connection. Yes, sorry.
Fără video de la el, că noi toți nu vedem. A, dar asta nu poate decât el.
De el să răspundă. Să răspundă fără video.
Aia nu-i
nu
ai?
Nu, el poate să răspundă cu video sau fără video. Da,
ok, Peter, you are with us again?
Yes.
Yeah, ok, sorry for the inconvenience.
Șeruiește ecranul, Liviu, e conectat.
Ok.
Liviu?
Now you can see the presentation again. Ok, great. Ok. So I said if function f satisfies this three conditions, the function h, sorry, from the definition of f satisfies conditions h1, h3. So in this way it is constructed actually f. And here I want to point out a few examples of function h satisfying this condition, these three conditions, for instance, sinus of t over 2, or the logarithm of 1 plus t multiplied with a small constant, or even more complicated function, like example 3, but I will not insist too much on these examples. I want to point out the main results, actually, on this problem. So if f is given by relation 5 here, then and h satisfies conditions h1, h3, then lambda 1, which was actually the first eigenvalue of problem 2, of this problem, given by relation 3 here, the first eigenvalue of problem 2, is still an eigenvalue of the new problem. It is isolated. We can prove that the set of corresponding eigenvectors is a code. And more than that, each lambda in 0, lambda 1 is not an eigenvalue, but there exists mu 1 strictly greater than lambda 1 such that each lambda in mu 1 infinity is an eigenvalue. Unfortunately, in this theorem, there is a gap. in the following sense. So what we know is that lambda 1 is an isolated element. That means that for a small epsilon, in open interval lambda 1 plus epsilon, there is no other element. On the other hand, we know that for mu 1 large enough, we always have an element. But it is possible to appear a gap. What happens in the interval lambda 1 plus epsilon mu 1? Are there eigenvalues or not? If there are eigenvalues, are they isolated or they are continuous family? These are for the moment questions on which we don't know to ask. And in order to end the presentation on the first problem, I want to say that similar results can be obtained if we replace the Laplacian by the free Laplacian. Okay. Now, in order to present my second problem, I will turn back to a problem like problem 2 presented before. The difference is that this time, on the boundary, we'll assume a Neumann boundary, a homogeneous Neumann boundary condition instead of a homogeneous Dirichlet boundary condition. And with similar arguments, we can prove again, for problem 6, the existence of a set of eigenvalues going again to plus infinity. The main difference is that this time the first eigenvalue is always 0, the number 0. However, in this case, even if the first eigenvalue is 0, it is still isolated, it is simple. Now, regarding the first positive eigenvalue of the problem, it can be obtained of the infimum, the same radic type Poitien as in the case of problem 2. The difference is that this time the infimum is taken in W12 and not in W10. This happens, of course, because of the new boundary condition, but we have to add this additional condition. This integral vanishes. Okay, so again, in case of problem 6, we have a discrete set of eigenvalues. Now, with putting the left hand side of problem 6 instead of the Laplace operator, the P Laplace operator, with P a constant strictly greater than 2. We obtain this new problem 7. On this problem, we can prove the existence of a continuous family of eigenvalues, namely again the interval 0 to infinity, this time closed in 0. So again, we have two problems, problem 6, in which the set of eigenvalues is discrete, problem 7, in which the set of eigenvalues is a continuous family. And then we consider the following question. What happens if in the left-hand side we take the sum between the P Laplacian and the Laplacian? What happens in the case of this new problem? Well, here a first problem which can occur is where we seek solutions, because the Laplacian asks for W12 and the P Laplacian for W1p. But since we are working on a boundary domain, it is very easy to solve this problem. We'll seek solutions in W1p. Next, again, we can define in a very natural manner what we understand by an eigenvalue of this new problem 8. A real number will be called an eigenvalue, again, if problem 8 possesses a non-trivial weak solution. And such a non-trivial weak solution mu lambda will be called an eigenfunction or eigenvalue corresponding to lambda. In this new context, our result is the following. For each number p strictly greater than 2, defining lambda 1 of p as being this infimum, the infimum of this quotient, which is nothing else but the radic quotient associated to problem 8 here, then we can prove that lambda 1 of p is positive always for each p greater than, strictly greater than 2. And this time we can describe entirely the set of eigenvalues of this problem as being the open interval lambda 1 p infinity, and on this continuous set of eigenvalues we add the isolated eigenvalue 0. So this is actually the nice part of this new problem, the fact that we can describe entirely the set of eigenvalues. One more thing I want to add here. When I first studied this problem, I was pretty sure that lambda 1 of p isn't taking value of the problem. But finally, really analyzing the problem, I noticed that it is not. Now, since for each p strictly greater than 2, we can introduce such a number, lambda 1 of p, actually there appears a function, lambda 1, defined from this interval to infinity to lambda 1 n infinity, lambda 1 n being the first positive eigenvalue of problem 6. Yes, it's characterized extremely simply. Okay, and on this function, now the one we can prove that it possesses some properties. I will not, I don't want to remember all of them, but just the last one, under some conditions, we can prove that lambda 1 possesses a fixed point. And then combining the results of these last two theorems, we can deduce the following consequence. There exists p strictly greater than 2, a constant, such that the set of eigenvalues of problem 8 is actually the interval p infinity plus the point 0. And actually, I will end here the discussion about eigenvalue problems, and I will go further to chapter 2, entitled Partial Differential Equations Involving Variable Exponent Growth.
Just a moment, Peter, yes. You're still with us?
Yes.
Good. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, now I will talk about the second chapter. It is entitled Partial Differential Equations Involving Variable Exponent Growth Conditions. And first of all, I want just to give a very small motivation for studying such kind of equations involving variable exponents. And such kind of equations actually became extremely popular in the last decades because they can serve as models in describing non-homogeneous phenomena, which occur from different branches of science. Just a few quick examples. Some models can be found in fluid mechanics, namely the so-called electrohelological fluids. Each time I pointed out a bibliographical reference, always there are a lot of bibliographical references, so it's just a selection here. Some other examples come from image restoration or image procession, from mathematical biology. They can occur in the study of the dielectric breakdown, electrical resistivity, polycrystal plasticity, the study of some models for the growth of heterogeneous cell types. And actually, on this last model, I want to say a few words in the end of this presentation. For the moment, I think it is not a bad idea to just say some words about variable exponent Lebesgue and Sokolov spaces, because such kind of spaces represent actually the framework where we can solve solution for when we study partial differential equations with variable exponents. And with that end in view, I will assume that omega in Rn is an open set. And then for any Lipschitz continuous function p defined from the closure of omega, taking values in the open interval 1 infinity, we can introduce p minus and p plus as being the atrium and the supremum of p over omega. Next, we can define the so-called variable exponent Lebesgue space denoted in this manner. I will refer visually to it as being Lp of x of omega as the set of measurable functions from which this integral here exists. This Lp of x of omega is actually a Banach space if we indulge it with a so-called Luxembourg norm defined here. For those who are familiarized with all its spaces, this definition of the Luxembourg norm is similar with the Luxembourg norm which is usually used on all its spaces. But anyway, all its spaces and variable exponent spaces are separate branches of a more general class of functional spaces, so-called Musialov space. But I don't want to enter into details here. What is important is that in the very particular case when function p is a constant function, this variable exponent Lebesgue space becomes the classical Lebesgue space, and the Luxembourg norm becomes a standard norm of such kind of space. Now, if we look at the definition of the Luxembourg norm, we see that it is not very easy to manipulate such a norm in applications. And because of that fact, usually in applications we prefer to use another mapping called the moduli of the space Lp of x of omega. Basically, this modular is the integral over omega of v of x of power p of x. But actually, this definition holds true only if the minimum of p, p minus, is strictly greater than 1 and the maximum of p, p plus, is strictly lower than infinity. I don't want to say that in the other cases we cannot define the modular. For instance, if p plus is plus infinity, we have here the second definition of the modal art, but at least in the problem that I want to present here, the first definition is enough. Okay, now a few relations between the Luxembourg norm and the modal art. For instance, if the Luxembourg norm is strictly greater than 1, then the modal art is between the Luxembourg norm of power v minus and the Luxembourg norm of power v plus. If by contrary, the Luxembourg norm is strictly lower than 1, then the above inequalities are reversed. And the Luxembourg norm is equal to 1 if and only if the modal art is equal to 1. Now, please note that in the particular case when p is a constant function, then p minus is actually equal to p plus, and then these inequalities becomes equalities. And then we deduce that the Luxembourg norm is the modular of power 1 over p. So this is, for instance, a motivation why I said that in the case when p is a constant function, the Luxembourg norm becomes the standard norm on classical Lebesgue space. Next, we can also introduce variable exponent subwave spaces in a very natural manner, like here. For such kind of spaces, we can introduce different equivalent norms. We can also introduce the space that we want to give back 0 as being the closure of C0 infinity under the norm on that we want to give x. And I pointed out here that under reasonable assumptions, these variable exponent spaces, Sobolev spaces, are separable and reflexive-bounded spaces. By reasonable assumptions, again, I mean that p minus is strictly greater than 1 and p plus is strictly lower than infinity. And this was somehow expected because in the case of constant exponents, the constant b should be enough in order to have separability and reflexivity of Sobolev spaces. We need b to be the open interval 1 infinity. Finally, in the particular case when omega is a bounded domain, this Sobolev space that we have here, on this Sobolev space, we can consider as a norm just the Luxembourg norm of the gradient instead of the sum between the Luxembourg norm of the gradient and the Luxembourg norm of u. And this is mainly due because in this case, we can prove a Poincaré-type inequality. But I want to point out here that this Poincaré type inequality actually holds true only for Luxembourg norms and not always for the modulars. And I will explain immediately some situations in which this equality, this Poincaré type inequality, does not hold true for modulars. But in order to end this section, I just want to point out some bibliographical references where we can find definitions and informations about variable exponent spaces, the book by Deming, Carletto, Castro, and Ruzica, and the book by Musiala, some papers by Edmund Lang, Medvinda, Edmunds, and Rakoschnik, or Kovacic and Rakoschnik. Of course, there are a lot of such kind of literature, a large amount of literature on this topic that I just considered a selection. And now, I want to say a few words about problem 11 here. So, this time, again, omega is a bounded domain with smooth boundary, yes. P is a function, is a continuous function defined on the closure of omega taking values in 1 infinity. And here, in the left-hand side, we have the so-called p of x Laplace operator, the p of x Laplacian, defined in this way, which is nothing else but the natural generalization of the more popular p Laplacian, obtained when p is a post. And lambda here is a real number. Well, on this problem, some results were established, for instance, in a paper from 2005 of Pan, Zhang, and Zhao. They proved, for example, that there are infinitely many eigenvalues of the problem, and they did that by using mainly Lüstenig-Schindermann critical point theory. Next, defining by capital lambda the set of eigenvalues of problem 11, they were able to prove that the supremum of capital lambda is plus infinity. But what is more interesting here, they proved that the minimum of capital lambda can be either positive or equal to 0. And this is very interesting because it is in sharp contrast with what happens in a case when p is a constant. Then we always have the minimum as being a positive number. But here, I want to point out another thing. Even if the minimum of capital lambda can be zero, this does not mean that zero is an eigenvalue of problem 11. Never, it is a terrible mistake to say that zero is an eigenvalue. It is enough to write what we understand by a weak, by an eigenvalue in a weak sense for problem 11 with lambda equal to zero here to see that the only solution in that case is u equal to zero. On the other hand, this discussion regarding the positivity of the minimum of capital lambda is also related to the positivity of this number denoted here by mu 1, which is the minimum of this quotient. This is again a really tight quotient associated with problem 11. And the idea is the following. The minimum of capital lambda is equal to zero if and only if mu 1 is equal to zero. Or the minimum of capital lambda is positive only if and only if mu 1 is positive. And examples where mu 1 can be equal to zero appears even from 2001, maybe even earlier, but I didn't find another example. Just this very simple example here on the real line. Which were extending later in the same paper by Franz Lang and Zhao from 2005 to the following result. If there exists an open set U in omega and an interior point x0 in U such that either p of x0 is strictly lower than p of x for each x on the boundary of U, or p of x0 is strictly greater than p of x for each x on the boundary of U, then U1 is 0.
You had a typo in your thesis here, right? You had different points less than strictly
it,
less
it is,
than
it is very possible. Sorry. It happens. I have more mistakes than this time. I
this was one of my
questions. Yeah, okay. Yes. So actually, this result means, in other words, that means that mu 1 is 0 if there exists an open set U such that the minimum of U is attained in an interior point of U and not on the boundary, or the maximum, the P is attained on an interior point and not on the boundary. Okay, now on the real line, there were introduced some necessary and sufficient conditions such that mu 1 should be positive. And such a condition is that p of x should be a monotone function in higher dimension. We have a sufficient condition. Mu 1 is positive. Mu 1 is positive if there exists a vector L in Rn such that for each point x in omega f is p of x plus f p, being p of x plus dl is monotone on a set of this type. Now, all the results that I presented until now on problem 11 are known results. Next, I want to point out some results where we want to supplement the above results in the first one is in the following sense. We still assume that omega is an open bounded as Moos said. And this time we assume that the variable exponent is a function of plus u1, so it is not only a continuous function. It is more than that. It is a plus u1. We also assume the existence of a function al, a vectorial function. This function is also a plus u1 or components. And we assume that conditions 12 and 13 are satisfied in the same time. Condition 12 asserts actually that the divergence of A is bounded from below by a positive constant in omega. Condition 13 asserts that the scalar product between A arrow and the gradient of P vanishes everywhere below. And of course, the first question here is, there are functions A arrow and P satisfying these two conditions. There are a lot of examples which can be provided. I pointed out here just one example. So let us assume that the dimension of Rn actually capital N is greater or equal than 3, omega is a ball. This is a ball centered in the origin of a small radius. Actually, the radius is not very important. And A of x will be not be equal exactly with x, but the first component here would be minus x1 instead of x1. And in this case, we can easily see that condition 12 is satisfied. Next, we can define p as being a polynomial function, like here. And if we compute this time the gradient of p, the scalar product between the gradient of p and a arrow, we obtain that condition 13 is satisfied. Okay, now under conditions 12 and 13, we can prove the existence of a positive constant C such that inequalities of type 14 here hold true. Please note that this function, which appears under the integral in the right-hand side of the inequality here, is actually a continuous function. So it is bounded. It is bounded from above. And that means that condition 14, particularly, implies the fact that mu1 is positive. So under conditions 12 and 13, mu1 is defined above is positive. But actually, this condition 14 means, in some particular cases, more than the fact that mu1 is positive. And I want to point out better what I want to say. So let us go back to example 1 again. And please note first that the Euclidean norm of A of x is actually the Euclidean norm of x, if it is defined like here. Then this inequality 14 in the case of example 1 reads like here, like inequality 15 here. The integrals are always on the ball centered in the origin, and the function which appears here under the integral on the right hand side is a function which vanishes in zero, so we have a singularity there. More than that, by this inequality, we can deduce that the minimum of the integral in the right-hand side over the integral in the left-hand side is always positive. And this new minimum is actually lower than mu1. So from this point of view, inequality 15 is a little bit, I don't know how to call it, stronger than the fact that mu1 is positive. Anyway, inequalities like 15 are also important because they enable us to study, for instance, partial differential equations with variable exponents, where here the differential operator is not exactly the p of x Laplacian that I introduced before, but it is an operator which possesses inside the divergence form a function which has singularities. And actually, this integral here in the right-hand side is nothing else but the energetic function which can be associated to the differential operator from problem 16. More than that, inequalities like 14 or 15 are just the starting point in proving some compact embedding theorems of some Sobolev type spaces which we can introduce in order to study problems like 16. And actually this is the first result that I wanted to present here. Next, I want to point out another type of result on which I worked. So we were also interested in studying problems like 16, but replacing this operator from the left-hand side by a so-called Grushin-type operator involving variable exponents. And let me explain, and let me introduce such an operator. We still assume that omega is a bounded and smooth domain. This time the dimension we assume that can be written as the sum of two integers greater or equal than 2. And then we can refer to each point in omega as being a pair x, y of points with x from Rn and y from Rm. And actually we'll be interested in defining Grushin-type operators with variable exponents and studying problem involving such kind of differential operators on domains omega that intersect the plane x equal to zero. I don't mean that other situations cannot be considered, but this is actually the most interesting situation. Okay, then what we did next, it was to define this square matrix of dimension n, defined like here, for a given real number gamma. We define it in this manner: I n and I m stand for unit matrices, and O and M, O M n are null matrices. And here, it is nothing else but the Euclidean norm of x of power gamma, and the Euclidean norm is taken in R small n, of course. Now, to be able to define our operator, we still need a function. I denote it here by g, but it is exactly the variable exponent b from the above examples. And then we can define this operator delta g, which is the divergence of this gradient type 4. So this gradient is the product between the matrix A of x defined above and this vector. For instance, if A of x is unit matrices, this operator is nothing here but G of x y Laplacian. If you want a P of x Laplacian with G instead of P. But it's not the case because A of x never can be the identity matrix because of its definition. Okay, why I call such an operator a Grushin type operator? Because in a very particular case when g is a constant function equal to 2 everywhere in omega, we refine the definition of the classical Grushin operator. It is pointed out here. It was introduced in early 70s by the Russian mathematician Grushin. Here we have the Laplacian with respect to x, the Laplacian with respect to plus the Laplacian with respect to y multiplied by this Euclidean norm of x of power gamma. This is a standard example of an operator which is not elliptic in domains intersecting the plane x equal to zero, and this is mainly due to the presence of this degeneracy. So what we did with this operator was to study problems like 16 here, and in order to do that, we assumed on G some properties. For instance, we assumed that G is can be written as the sum between two functions, P depending only on X and Q depending only on Y. These functions are plus C1. And C1 on the projections of omega on Rn and Rm. And satisfying conditions like 17 and 18, such kind of conditions are inspired basically from conditions Bernstein 13 introduced earlier, and we can consider a similar theory like for problem 16, but considered for putting in the left hand side this solution type over. And I will stop here the discussion on chapter 2, and I will jump now to chapter 5, which is entitled the asymptotic behavior of some homogeneous functionals. And from this chapter, I will discuss actually the last section entitled Models for Curves of Heterogeneous Setpiles via Moskow Convergence. Okay, here in order to give an idea from the start about what kind of results we want to prove here, I will introduce the sequence of functionals, Hn, defined on this Hilbert space, L2 of Rn, and given by a relation of type 19. What is particular for this sequence of functions is, on the one hand, the presence of a variable exponent, a function p of x defined on the whole space Rn. This is assumed to be a bounded function. And another bounded function, yes, lambda of x, again, I think I've just typed the branch to be. Peter?
Yes.
You still hear us?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. So we can define Hn like in relation 19, and then we can roughly speaking, we are interested in studying if HM converges in a certain sense to another function. And actually it converges in the sense of Moskov to functional H infinity given by relation term. For the moment, I don't want to introduce the definition of the Moskov convergence. I will do it a little bit later. I think it is interesting here to try to give some explanations which is the relation between Moskov convergences and models for the growth of heterogeneous sandpipes. And in order to do that, I want to talk about some known results on evolution problems. And I will ask you to first to focus your attention on problems like 21 here. So what we have here for each real number p from the interval 1 infinity, so for the moment p is a real number, it is not a function. We have here the Laplacian. This Laplacian is taken with respect to x variable, to space variable. And here we have the derivative with respect to time. And for each such of p, we consider that in problems like 21, f and u0 are given function the same each time. And they are choose such that for each p we have a solution of problem 21. And then actually we are interested in what happens with the sequence of solutions vp when v goes to infinity. And such kind of investigations were pointed out, for instance, in such kind of papers like the 2-1 pointed out here by Evans, Feldman, and Gargetti, and Aronson, Evans, and Fu. Actually, if we define this sequence of functionals for each number b from 1 infinity, where on the first branch we have here nothing else but the energetic functional associated to the Laplacian, then we can rewrite problem 21. We can reformulate it like here, the second problem from this slide. And here in the right hand side we have nothing else but the subdifferential of fp. Now, assuming that u0 and f satisfy some conditions, which I don't want to read, even Spellman and Garhippi proved the following result. There exists a sequence pi going to plus infinity and the limit function b infinity such that for each positive number t, capital T, pi converges to b infinity almost everywhere and in L2. Regarding the derivatives, both with respect to space and time, they converge weakly in L2. What happens with this limiting function? It can be characterized. It can be characterized as being the solution of problem 22 here, where in this problem, in the right-hand side, we have the subdifferential of f infinity. F infinity is this function. It is zero if the Euclidean norm of the gradient is less or equal to one and plus infinity otherwise. What we can say that represent this problem 22, this limiting problem governs the movement of a sand pipe with b infinity of tx describing the amount of sand at point x of time t under the main assumption that the sand pipe is stable if the slope is less or equal to 1 and unstable otherwise. So this is the result of Evans, Feldman, and Gariev. What we try to do as an application of our Moskov convergence results, we wanted to extend the above model to models which take into account the fact that the admissible slopes may depend explicitly on the special location due, for instance, to the presence of heterogeneous. Now, I will try to explain better what I wanted to say here. So, in the start of this chapter, I defined the functionals Hn by relation 19, which I just such kind of functionals, and for each n, we can to associate to functional f h n partial differential equation like 23. let us assume that for each m, such an equation has a solution in m. Then, using our Moscow convergence results and some classical results from papers by Atush and Brezis and Pazzi pointed out here, we can prove that um converges to u, this time u being the solution of problem 24. This time here we have the subdifferential at h infinity. H infinity is the limiting functional. Is the limiting functional for sequence hm given here. What happens with this functional h infinity here? This functional is stable, so the sen pi is stable for this part. If we refer to this functional and to the model of the sen pi, we can see that the sen pi is stable if the slope is less or equal than a function depending on x, 1 over lambda of x to the power 1 over p of x. And even if lambda is a constant different by 1, we have here a dependence of x if we have in the definition a functional as 19, a variable exponent. So the variable exponent gave the dependence of x in the limiting function. So in other words, what I tried to explain here is that regarding problem 24, the above limiting problem can be seen as a model for the growth of a sen pi, where the critical slope of the sen depends on the spatial location. This is what I'm trying to explain. Now, so actually, this is the relation between the Moscow convergence and growth of sen pi.
So, excuse me, yes. Can you remind us what Moscow convergence is?
This is what I want to do right now. Okay. So now I want actually to point out the results, the real results that we proved regarding this this chapter, this section from chapter 5. So I will start with the definition of the Moscow convergence. Let H to be a Hilbert space, and let us assume that psi n is a sequence of complex and lower semi-continuous functionals from H to this interval, and we'll see that psi n converges in the sense of Moscow to another convex and lower semi-continuous functional psi if these two conditions are satisfied. The first condition basically asserts that if that for each u in the domain of psi there exists a so-called recovery sequence. The second condition asserts that for each subsequence nk, psi is lower or equal than this inferior limit whenever you take the converges with each other. Okay. Now the Moscow convergence results. In order to point out that the first result, let Pn be the sequence of functions from L infinity, satisfying conditions 25 and 26. Condition 25 asserts basically that the sequence of numbers pn minus goes to plus infinity. Second condition is a type of Harnack type inequality. There exists a universal constant gamma, which is here pointed out to be strictly greater than 1. It can be also equal to 1 in case of constant sequences, constant functions, such that pn plus is lower or equal than gamma multiplied by pn minus. And this happens for each natural number. We also need, in order to formulate our results, a function mu, defined on R and A in Benzene intervals of this type, which we assume that it belongs to a certain Hilbert space, then defining the sequence of functionals f, m in this manner, we can prove that the sequence of functionals converges to f infinity, in the sense of Moscow. Why is interesting this example of Moscow convergence? This example, at least from two points of view. First of all, let us assume that the function which appears here in the definition of f and mu is not a zero function. Zero function is a good candidate for function mu, but let's assume that it is not a x. If you want, it looks like the second function. Okay, and let us assume that the sequence of exponents here, pn of x, for each n, these functions are constant functions. Pn of x is, for instance, equal to f every n. Then fn, okay, if this if pn of x is equal to n for each n, then it is easy to check that 25 and 26 are satisfied. means that the effect of force is to F infinity in the sense of motion. What is interesting here? In the definition of the limiting functional in this inequality, here we have a dependence of x in right hand side, even if the sequence of exponents involved here is a sequence of constant functions. And this dependence is due to the fact that mu depends on x. So we can create dependence of x here, even if we are working with sequences of constant exponents. On the other hand, now another remark. Let us assume this time that mu is equal to zero everywhere, but the sequence of exponents here for each ampere of x is a real function, depending on x. Then, again, fn will converge to f infinity in the Moskov sense. But this time, even if in the definition of fn we have some variable exponents, in the definition of f infinity, the function here in the right-hand side of this inequality is a constant function, so it doesn't depend on x. Okay. Now, what happens in the particular case when my sequence pn of x is of this type, n multiplied with a given function depending on x? Then it is very easy to check that conditions 25 and 26 are satisfied. So the result of the first theorem here regarding the Moskov convergence of fn to f infinity holds true. But it also holds true the result of theorem 2. The result of theorem 2 means that hn converges in the sense of Moskov to h infinity, hn and h infinity being actually the functionals introduced in the start of this chapter. And as I pointed out before, this time the gradient, the Euclidean norm of the gradient of u is lower or equal than a function which depends on x, and this dependence in some particular cases is due to the presence of the variable exponent. Now, in both cases of theorems 1 and 2, please note that in the definition of the limiting functional h infinity or f infinity, this is a kind of degenerate function. It is zero on a branch and plus infinity on the other. So we have no dependence of u actually in the value of f infinity or h infinity of u. And then we ask, we can provide an example of a Moskov convergence where the definition of the limiting functional to have a dependence of u. And we were able to do that by taking here lambda of x to be equal 1 everywhere and taking these integrals of power 1 over n, like in example theorem 3 here, defining gn in this manner, we can prove that gn converges in the sense of Moskov to g infinity, and this time on the first branch we have the n infinity norm, the Euclidean norm, the gradient of power p of x, so we have a definition of x. Of you here. And okay, I will stop here with my presentation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, so now after this presentation, I will invite the members of the commission to ask questions. So I suggest we start with Peter Haskell. Peter?
Okay.
So, were you able to follow? Are you ready to ask questions?
Yes.
Great.
So, I guess my first question, actually all of these questions are kind of general. In several results, eigenvalue is also particular. There were some conditions depend on like e plus or e minus.
Which depend on?
E plus or q minus or something.
Okay.
Like so you take like the even or supremum over exponent where say in some situations where also some variable exponent condition might seem more weaker. So I wonder if you know in any of these cases this condition with the p plus or q minus or p minus or whatever, is it actually necessary?
Just a moment to see if I understood your question. So actually you refer to problems. Just a moment. To the study of eigenvector problems with a variable exponents, okay. Where just a moment. Maybe you refer to
you refer to
this result, isn't it?
This presentation at all, or is it just in the thesis? So
are not in the presentation?
I'm not sure it's in the presentation. Check if I can find any here.
Well, I don't know the number of this of the slide. Please let me stop for the stop. So slide 41, yes? Okay, yes, I found it. So there is a theorem, yes. Assuming the compacity of the embedding of a subvolatile space with a variable exponent into a Lebesgue space. And you, I understand that you want to know if such compact embeddings are possible in other keys that you don't give to that interval. Is it true?
I can formulate now more exactly. So,
okay.
In this case, I mean, it is known that if you just think about the function spaces, then you can also add some compact embedding into the LQX.
Yes.
So this I know, but what the actual question is then, is that all of these results for eigenvalues, then you also have some condition in terms of, say, in this case, d minus. But do you know if any of these cases is actually necessary to have this d minus? Or is this also just for technical reasons? Or
I think it is for technical reasons.
And to work on
example one, actually, it is also asked by the particular form of example one, where we are working on a ball. And if I well remember, all these facts should be taken into account.
Okay. I'm afraid I didn't understand very well, but hopefully you answer correctly. I'm kind of lost now. So, Katrin?
Yes, I will have several questions.
Yes,
I will try to speak louder. So, for the first chapter, eigenvalue problems,
yes.
For non-linear eigenvalue problems, you said that there is a gap between the first eigenvalue, which is isolated, and then the set of
yes.
continuous eigenvalues. You don't know.
I will go back to that problem.
So my question in this situation is, do you have not only feelings, but let's say examples, for example, in symmetric domains with some homogeneous conditions on the homogeneity conditions on the nonlinearity, in which you are able to say exactly which is the behavior? For example, if domain is a sphere and
I tried everything to solve, at least in a very particular case, such a problem. But it's really difficult. All the traditional methods seems to do not work.
Because my feeling is that when you have some extra symmetric conditions, that there is a reduction of dimension of the problem. So you have, you said, for example, radial something.
It is possible to be correct what you say, but I tried and I didn't succeed.
Okay, thank you. So some examples. So this nonlinear, I always wonder if these nonlinear eigenvalue problems are coming from physical models or something, or is somehow
actually this? I looked at this kind of problems more than a pure mathematical problem. Because I found that interesting fact that in some cases we have a discrete spectrum actually, and in other cases a continuous.
I know
this
that
was
the
only
standard,
reason.
But
no,
for
but
velocities, they really come for very concrete physical, let's say, model. Now, second question. In the second chapter, variable exponent
yes.
growth conditions,
yes.
You said that P should be Lipschitz continuous.
Yes.
Why is it so important to be Lipschitz? And I suppose that later you suppose that it is even C1 because you had that condition with A dot gradient of P equals 0.
So,
Peter, did you mean this P plus and P minus in your question?
Yes, yes, exactly. These are P plus and P minus.
Is this still there?
Peter.
Okay.
So,
where these your you
so referring these to this P term? Minus and P plus are actually the two constants
yeah.
about I talked with Peter.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my question is it important for P to be Lipschitz continuous?
Well, you know, actually, variable exponent Lebesgue spaces can be introduced even under weaker conditions on P. But
for example, L infinity is on
L
half of the domain is L one, half of the domain is L two. Is it good?
L infinity, I think, is a good choice as possible.
Because
I think
what comes
from applications, because you see. Such kind of partial differential equations with variable exponents are related with, for instance, with this idea of modeling, for instance, electrochemical fluids, and when examples, I guess, at least in my opinion, when examples comes from physics or whatever. Then we need a kind of regularity in order to model the processes.
No, because my curiosity is because later
yes,
we spoke about
it can be defined under weaker conditions.
So you don't use exactly that Lipschitz condition.
No, I cannot say that.
Now my question is the following, because it should be very interesting, which is the dependence, so you establish some existence of eigenvalues, which is the dependence on P? Let's say in the class of continuous exponents P, is there a dependence, for example, in the C of omega part topology of the eigenvalues of the solution? I don't know exactly, for example, I don't know which is the regularity of such an operator. If the right-hand side is in some LP of X, what is how regular is U? So what can we say about the regularity of U?
Sometimes it happens something similar with what happens for the post-East, I think not always. So I'm not an expert in regularity, I have to recognize.
No, because usually you work with the regularity in these variational problems, and you say that, okay, you, the right-hand side in this time space, like bootstrap argument, and you say, okay, U is regular. And now I come to the question, which is the dependence of U on P of the eigen, because later you have, in the last chapter, you have the Moscow convergence. Is it not the gamma convergence? Is the same?
No, it's not the same. It's a little bit more general. This
Moscow convergence
and the gamma convergence.
Okay.
Because I have also some results on
the.
It's very similar. It's very
my
similar.
Idea came just now in your presentation because you have Moscow convergence for Pn, which goes to infinity. Okay, Pn goes to infinity. And there is some extra condition, Pn less equal lambda Pn minus.
So here, actually, these are the basic conditions which should be satisfied. Pn minus goes to plus infinity, and Pn plus is...
Well, this is stopping your Pn to have oscillations, high oscillations.
Yes.
You cannot have a P n with high oscillations, and because 36 is blocking this. So my question would be, as a further study, maybe there is something done in this direction. If, for example, you take a P n which is highly oscillating but bounded in an infinity, what can you say at the limits? Is there a formula?
This is a very good question, but I think it is very difficult to answer to it, because why we impose actually this type of inequalities. So the basic idea is the following. Let me take this this example, because it's the best one. So here, if we consider gradient of u of x and power p of x, this is nothing else but the ln norm. Yes, the ln norm of the gradient of u of x and power p of x. Let's neglect this term in the right. And then what do we show? We show that when n goes to infinity, ln norm converges to an infinity norm. So I cannot enable to the exponent to vary too much, you know, in order to I should be close to this classical result for LP norms. So basically, conditions like 26 are introduced to be able to generalize to, in some special cases of variable exponents, results like ln norm converges to L infinity norm on domains with finite measure, of course.
Okay, but probably there is not such a similar. Let's say Pn is converging to something.
So actually, my explanation is not even correct here, because we are working on Rn. But basically, this is the idea.
Okay, so this is quite different. It will not work on the same road, but probably.
It is possible to obtain such kind of results even for.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I
didn't
know.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Peter, do you have other questions?
Yes. Yes, I have a few.
Yes.
Well, another general question also has to do with this eigenvalue of results. You presented here in the talk a few results that you don't exist for. But I'm wondering if you have some kind of vision or synthesis on this kind of eigenvalue results that may explain. It seems to me that there are lots of people that have studied these eigenvalue results. I think 2 years ago we were writing this survey on variable exponents.
Yes.
Which results that we had a very difficult time to try to integrate the vector results at that time. And now I think there are many new results. So do you see that these kind of studies of eigenvalue, are they headed in some direction? Will we get some kind of one result which will encompass all the different cases? Or do you just foresee this kind of very large number of very separate or different kind of results?
So you referred to the results actually, to the results where we introduced conditions like 12 and 13 from the top, or
what was the number?
Okay.
So, you know, these kind of eigenvalue results.
have to recognize that here is not actually necessarily a result regarding eigenvalues problems, but it is related somehow with these eigenvalue problems. Actually, if you look at problem 16, but let us assume that in the left-hand side we don't have differential operator, this divergence operator, but the Grushin type operator. So actually this was our main goal, to study equations if you want like 16, where in the left-hand side we have the Grushin type operator. The fact that type of Grushin type operator with variable S point that we introduced. The fact that it is related to it can be related somehow with the study of some eigenvalues problems it just happened. So we didn't want really to study an eigenvalue problem, you know? So what we tried to do, it was to study different operators involving variable exponents where are present some singularities or degeneracies in the differential operator. Because this
you can ask a similar question. I mean, you have a result for some particular operator, but do you think that it is possible to get some theory for a general, like maybe not this particular singularity, this x to the power of the
I can tell you what I'm trying to do now. Now I'm trying to obtain a similar result, but replacing this, the framework is totally different. I want to replace this Euclidean norm of x, the power p of x, for instance, to the distance function to the boundary at a certain power. But you see, for distance function, actually, the framework with this Euclidean norm of x, the power, this is also singular. And it is singular in all the points on the boundary, isn't it? And I tell you, it's more difficult to study this. I have some ideas. For instance, I have some small results on the ball, but only on this very particular case. Because what happened? Actually, here we took omega to be a ball, but it doesn't. This is not really necessary. We can take omega to just. To have zero as an interior point in order to create the singularity with f sub power p of s. But if I take the distance function, then for general domain, I don't have a formula for the distance function. For a ball, I have the radius, I don't know, square radius minus the Euclidean norm of x on the square, something like that. I hope I didn't say something stupid. But otherwise, for general domains with for instance, with distance function seems to be really difficult to obtain results.
So was Peter, was your question about whether he has a general method of attacking eigenvalue problems for this quasi-linear or semi-linear eigenvalue problems? If he has a program to find one result?
Yes, there is a method, but at least whether there is some kind of, it's kind of an imprecise question about the development or future direction of this kind of problems. So whether it is possible to go from lots of particular cases to some more general cases.
Otherwise, it's difficult to say.
Yes.
Yes.
Or actually,
calculation, yes.
And I also thought about hiring and collecting. So do you think that this condition A dot gradient P is equal to zero, is this somehow close to a necessary condition for this kind of inequality or for the
okay, I understand your question. So it is necessary, but only for, again, for hard inequalities, I'm pretty sure that it is necessary, but for hard inequalities involving, again, the Euclidean norm of x and not the distance function to the boundary. If we put the distance function to the boundary, the problem should be totally different. In my opinion, at least. By other type of functions P of X which do not satisfy conditions by Donald Kerner's certainism. I have no idea.
So
I understand, but I have no idea. I tried to find an example, but I didn't succeed.
The condition 13 means that P is constant along the flow lines of A, of the vector field A.
No, but let me just as, because we talk now about conditions 12 and 13. I want to do an interesting comment here. I didn't point it out, but you see from actually if conditions 12 and 13 are satisfied, then function P, then mu 1 will be positive. Yes. So this is one of the constants. If mu 1 is positive, it means that function P actually cannot attain its minimum or maximum on the boundary of a certain open set U inside omega. So this is a kind of maximum principle which can be proved for solutions P of equation 13, satisfying equation 13, when A arrow is a given function. This is something that I didn't see pointed out. I discussed actually such kind of maximum, because such kind of maximum minimum principles force to even if in relation 13 we take not the equality to zero, but to have something like greater or equal to zero or less or equal to zero, you know? And each time we can formulate such kind of maximum principles. But they are known. They are known even, I understood that they are known even for the case of viscosity solutions, and it is a book by Fargin and Capuzzo Dolcetta, I think, about viscosity solutions of Hamilton-Jacobi equation, where such kind of results can be found.
Okay, so I also have some questions. Maybe let me go to equation 117 from the thesis.
Oh.
So I don't know what this corresponds to in terms of the here. So have you talked about this? Section 1.4. I had a question about this because it's so I'm asking about section 1.4 from the thesis.
Yes.
It seems to have a linear equation for once. It seems to be the only linear equation in the whole thesis. So my question was related to theorem 1.5. First, this seems to me that it's a conform by a conformal change of metric. This is just a Laplace operator on a cone. So you take a radial conformal change.
It's possible to be true. Not so tough in geometry.
Good. So then my question was, whether do you know that this operator that you have here is essentially self-adjoint? So this is something particular to a linear operator.
For that, well, for trivializers.
And do you know in theorem 1.5?
I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's.
It seems to be.
So there are, if you look at it from a geometric point of view, the metric is incomplete in zero. And you have a singularity in zero where it's incomplete. So it's not clear if it's self-adjoint or not.
Actually, that's why I studied a problem, because it was
a so my question about theorem 1.5 is whether, okay, whether you know some eigenvalue count. Like counting eigenvalues less than a number, less than n, and you let n go to infinity and find asymptotics of the eigenvalues less than n. So you take f of n to be the number of eigenvalues less than n.
Okay.
Let n go to infinity and look at f of n, and it could be some polynomial of n, I mean in the leading. So you're having
from this point of view.
Okay, then I have a sort of very general question. How appropriate is to use the name eigenvalue for nonlinear operators? So in what sense are they eigenvalues? It's just you have some parameter that you vary, so, but it's not eigenvalue, because it's not a linear operator.
Yes, I understand. So,
is it
okay, so I understand.
Is it you or is it?
No. There are a lot of mathematicians making this confusion, maybe. So, I understand. So, the idea is that usually eigenvalue problems means here in the right hand side lambda multiplied by u, isn't it? But you know, if you want, for instance, here to create a kind of homogeneity. When you study the problem, since the operator in the left-hand side is at this particular form, in order to create this homogeneity, which is usually considered that.
No, it has something to do with the min-max principle.
Which is
because the formula suggests it's a min-max force. So probably it comes from the idea of
And then I have two remarks about the thesis on page 39. Sorry, this is kind of technical.
Okay.
So on page 39 of the thesis, you have a notion of an L phi norm, and I don't know what the G is.
It is for sure a mistake.
It's probably something else.
It is U.
V, right?
Or V. It's V. It's
V.
Yes,
okay.
It's V. It's called a yes.
Then, okay, it's not very important, but just.
No, but
it's correct. And then on page 90, also I don't understand what, on page 90 there is a f belongs to some ut plus del of u.
So, yes, so this
what
is this is the sub-differential of h infinity in u. So h infinity is...
The functional, right?
It's the functional in this defined
yes.
Here. We compute the sub-differential and then, well, if you want it, f minus ut belongs to this.
Okay.
It's more correct in this, or is it this one?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then, yeah, Katalin, do you have other questions?
Oh, okay.
You're done. Peter, do you have other questions? Or we can also ask questions from the audience, and if you have more questions, you can ask them.
Well, I would ask one question now if you were discussing this thesis, which was not mentioned at all in this talk of this discrete.
Oh, yes. So,
discrete compensation four. So there just has some general question.
Yes.
So what we're working with these discrete equations, you also somehow make it like. The weak solution, for instance, on page 62 of the thesis.
62, yes.
But I'm wondering.
No, weak solution is the same notion. So it has no sense to define weak solution when you are working with discrete equation. It is a mistake, of course. It's a mistake.
So that was kind of a discrete case, of course.
No, no, it's a mistake that I did here. I remark it later, yeah. After I wrote the thesis. Yeah. You are perfectly right.
Yes, so in this case, actually,
formulation
in the lower part of the page is equivalent to
4.2? Yes, it's equivalent to
4.2. Okay. Yeah, I guess that was it for my part.
Okay, you can ask more questions if you find more during the... So now we are for the audience. It's your turn to ask questions. And I have the thesis if someone wants to. Yes.
It's not exactly a question, it's more of a curiosity. I wonder if there are any attempts to extend such results to Laplace Deltard operators on Riemannian manifold. Some of your results look like suited for Riemannian geometry. So, for example, the Gaussian operator seems to be related to some walk products.
Well, I have to recognize that I never seen such a connection, but I think it's a good,
so it's a good
question.
Do you know anything about the test results?
No. Actually, this seems to be quite disconnected from them. People who do this like RN.
Yes,
they are
disconnected,
but
the results.
So, more questions?
Yes, I have a hint to your question about the eigenvalue. So, there is a similar situation when, let's say, instead of delta P, you have delta, and P is a natural number, and not with absolute value of u, but still non-linear. And then it's possible to associate to this non-linear equation a linear one on the space of measures, and the eigenfunction, an eigenfunction from this linear equation become by restriction to the original space to the as an eigenfunction to the nonlinear equation. So there are indeed situations when eigenfunction problems from nonlinear equations are reduced to linear ones. So there is a motivation for this even from this point of view. I can give you details. But in a special situation, not precisely like this.
So more questions? I had maybe not a very fair question. Can you give us some short words about the proof of a theorem like theorem 1.5? So you're saying that a certain linear operator has an increasing infinite sequence of eigenvalues. How do you prove something like that?
Something similar is what happens in the classical case when you have minus delta E equal to lambda mu, I guess, or A. So it's something like a Ries practical theory for compacted zeta joints of greater than or two lemmas that
but this is in this is linear, right? This is close from linear operators.
Exactly. There are some difficulties, of course, but roughly speaking,
But solve it. I mean, you said the technique is linear, similar to that to the linear problem.
Because it is a semi-linear problem.
1.4 is linear, not semi-linear.
No, not for here, because of
yes.
Okay, so you have orthogonality with respect to some.
Exactly, it's the same thing.
But here you must choose appropriately the functional space you work in, otherwise the result is empty. Because if you just choose a space which is too big, you'll be
wrong. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so I trust you this.
Good. So if there are no more questions, then we can declare this stage of the defense closed. And probably Peter with us will just stay online, or maybe I will call you on my computer. Peter, is it okay? I will call you on my computer. You will just have to.
Okay. Yes.
You will have to say yes to my friendship.
Okay.
Okay. So talk to you soon. Care este acum procedura și ne rămâne în...
Mai bine mergeți într-o sală.
Imediat.